I am grateful for Sunday school times because typically the format in Sunday school is that it's a lot more informal, right?
Yes. I hope.
Okay, good. So I'm going to do something a little bit maybe, I don't know how different this is for you all, but I want to ask you to interact with me during this time. I have notes. I can prove that to you, but I don't really want to just go off my notes because I have found that when the Spirit of God leads me to a discovery from the passage, it often means so much more to me than if I just receive it lecture style and not in an auditory sense. So what I'd like to do this Sunday school time, after this morning's message dealing with what does it mean to wait on God, I'd like to for us to ask the question or to consider, what are the errors when we don't wait on God? You ever experienced that, where you didn't wait for the Lord and the difficulty that came from it? Remember when I was a boy, my dad was pastoring in the state of New York for a couple of years, and their van, I think at that point there was five of us, I'm one of eight children, I think at that point we had five kids in our family, and so the van that my parents had was rusted and fallen apart, and I had to get a new one, and my dad was feeling the crunch, and there was a van that he saw on the side of the road. He had no peace about it. My mom had no peace about it. And yet, the time was near and the crunch and the pressure, and he just bought the van because he couldn't stand to not have figured out how else he was going to get a van. And often, we do make decisions because we want to have some semblance of control, because waiting means we yield our control. And he had said many years after, he said, that was the worst van I have ever purchased in my life. We've all probably experienced something like that, where the pain of waiting was too great, we thought, and so we hastened to do something, and it was far worse. You just wanted something so bad, you finally went up. Maybe that new vehicle, or that hunting trip, or that new rifle, or I don't know what ladies yearn for, but those are things that guys yearn for. And you decide you're not going to wait, and you just buy it, and then it's like it's sick in your stomach. It just doesn't satisfy the pitfalls of waiting. So what I would like to do, I've got four different illustrations in the Old Testament when people failed to wait. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to work through those accounts, and I want us to try to just unpack it together, what I would call a discovery Bible study, where we're just going to inductively look through this and ask ourselves, what are the errors in this passage and how does it apply to me? So let's go to Genesis chapter 15. Actually, we're going to go to Genesis 16. We'll just go right to there. And you're probably familiar already as I give you the reference where we're going. The first one is going to be that of Abraham or Abram. God had given him a promise in the previous chapter, in chapter 15. So as you're turning to chapter 16, I'll read a couple verses in chapter 15. Genesis 15 says this, after these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? Of course, I'm not going back to Genesis 12. Genesis 12 is when God would give him that covenant that we would call the Abrahamic covenant, when he's telling him there's going to be a land, there's going to be a seed, there's going to be the promise to deliver, all of that that comes. 15, again, this reiteration, and Abram here is saying to the Lord, Father, this doesn't make sense to me how all of this is going to happen because I don't have any children, and the one that's in my house is this Eliezer of Damascus, verse 3 of Genesis 15. And Abram said, behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir. So there apparently was a custom in that time that if there was someone born in your house, if you did not have children, that servant would become your heir. And he's basically saying, God, this doesn't line up with the promise that you gave me. Eliezer is going to be my heir, and that doesn't make sense to me. Verse 4, and behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, this, meaning Eliezer, shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. So as God gives that promise to him, and as you and I read it, what is the natural intended assumption this promise, what is it God is saying? Is he saying, okay, you know, it's not going to be Eliezer, but there's going to be kind of this backdoor way you'll get a child. Is that what God was saying? Or was it when he said to Abraham, a seed that comes out of your own bowels, what is it that Abram assumed that promise meant? I'm probably not asking the question well.
He'd be a father.
Yes, he'd be a father. And who would Sarah, and what would Sarah be? Yeah, the assumption clearly, and it's not, this isn't a wrong place to assume, this is what God is saying to them, and he understands it accurately. As Abraham leaves this conversation with the Lord, he is convinced, Eliezer's not going to be my seed, is not going to be my my heir. God is going to give a child to Sarah and I. Was that what God intended for Abram to come away being convinced of? Yes. So now, fast forward 10 years later, and we're in chapter 16. Look at these words. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. Man, 10 years is a long time, and still no baby, and she's getting old. She's beyond the point where natural birth bearing makes sense. And after 10 years of waiting on this promise, you're starting to wonder, God, what are you doing? Can you identify with those thoughts? So what is her conclusion in verse 1 of chapter 16? Because that's a question now. If I'm not careful, I'll just teach. So I got to force myself to get to ask you the question. So what is Sarah's assumption? 10 years, I'm still barren. So here's what we're going to do. What was her assumption? Yeah, we're going to try and experiment. What does she think of God at this point?
He's failed.
Or he's just being mean. Look at the next verse. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold, now the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. One commentator made this note. She recognized the sovereignty of God. She recognized God's in control of the womb, and he's kept me from bearing. So we're going to try to go around his sovereignty and figure out another way. So she's going to try an experiment. So what is it that she assumes, or what is the experiment that they want to try?
Do it her own way.
Yes. And the own way?
Give back up.
Yep.
Her handmaid to her.
Yes. Hagar. Now there's a phrase here in middle of verse 2. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarah. So there, I was reading on this verse, there's indication that there would have been a custom that Sarah and the handmaid would have actually been in the same tent, and Abraham would have had relations with the handmaid. There's a phrase in reference to Rachel with Bilhah of the idea of bearing children on my knees. There was an understanding that there was a custom that this was not necessarily a sensual relationship between Abram and Hagar as much as this lady would have come in, and some believe that actually she would have sat on the lap of Sarai, and there would have been that human relationship, and by the act of being all together, you could kind of take by proxy as your child. Now, I read that in a commentary as I was working through this, and it's like, well, that's kind of strange. Well, we don't practice it, obviously, that way. But clearly what Hagar is trying to do is, I can't bear, so let's figure out another way to make this sort of legit. Let's figure out another way to make this seem like this will work. And does it work? Well, they have the baby. But the moment that she conceives, look down at verse 3. Verse 4. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. So it seems at that point, Hagar got in her head, like, I am better now than my mistress. There seemed to be a haughtiness even at that point. And Sarah, now in her envy and jealousy, becomes angry with Abram, blames Abram. Look at verse 6. But Abram said unto, verse 5, Sarah said unto Abram, my wrong is upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. I would not want to be in that conversation. Sarah's not a very nice lady at this point. And Abram, not willing to take responsibility or leadership, turns Hagar over to Sarah, who then mistreats her. She runs away. God meets Hagar and Ishmael there in the field, promising to take Ishmael. And God comes back around to Abram and says, this was not the way you were supposed to fulfill this promise. So you say, okay, we messed up. But what is the result of that relationship and Ishmael? What's the result? We know historically. Yeah, if you watch the headlines of what's coming out of Israel and in that Palestinian area, they're still dealing with the trouble that went all the way back to Genesis chapter 16. Because God's promises are not void, and when he promises that there's going to be blessing of some level onto a seed, even if it's an illegitimate relationship, God still promised to bless Ishmael. But he says, that's not the way I was going to do it. And so we see, fast forward later, Abram and Sarah have Isaac. So let's just pause here for a moment and ask these questions. What was Sarah's and Abram's mistake? Yes, ma'am. Okay. They didn't wait on God. Why didn't they wait on God? Yes, sir? Yes, a lack of faith. In who? In Sarah's womb? No. In God. Right. In God's providence, in God's sovereignty, in God's ability. Why did they fail in this area of waiting? Why didn't they wait? Yes, ma'am? Yeah. They thought God had passed them up. And so when God's passed them up, they're going to do it on their own. And how does that turn out? Okay. We in that. Can you think of a time when you've gotten impatient with the Lord and you've tried to work around his plan, his way, because we've forgotten his sovereignty, his goodness, and his timing? God, who created time, yet lives outside of time, desires to use the constraints of time to teach us great things. My mind immediately goes to the New Testament when a sister runs to Jesus and says, Lord, if you had come in the right amount of time, my brother would still be alive. And what is it that Jesus says? It says, responds to her, I am the resurrection and the life. That young lady had concluded that time is run out. You've failed us. Nothing else can come through. However, I still know you're a deliverer if you would do something. Jesus says, I am the resurrection. She says, I know Lazarus will be resurrected someday. But Jesus says, no, I still can deliver. How many of us have made foolish decisions because we're at the table and we say, God couldn't deliver now? When he asked for the tomb to be opened up, what is the response of everybody there in the crowd? It's been 4 days and he stinks. Have you and I ever had that response to the Lord? God, this situation stinks and it's too late. Now, I'm not necessarily in agreement with this style of music, but a friend of mine told me some time ago, you ought to listen to this song. There's an old Southern gospel song that goes like this. When he's 4 days late, he's still on time. I mean, isn't that something? You know, God has never known a time constraint. There has never been a time when it's too late for God. He can work beyond that. So my challenge to us in our first error in waiting is this. Let us not lay with Hagar because we will not trust God for Isaac. I don't know what it is that maybe you're working through right now. Waiting for that husband, waiting for that wife, waiting for that grandchild, waiting for that resolution in the church that I have no clue about. I mentioned at the beginning of the message, impatient people hurt a lot of people. And what we see at the end of this story is failing to wait on God leads to human results and hurt people. Go to Exodus chapter 2. We're going to go to the next one. So next book over, Exodus chapter 2. we are introduced to a man that is a pretty special man. Starts as a baby, verse 1 of chapter 2, Exodus 2, verse 1. And there was when a man in the house of Levi took to wife a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to wit what should be done to him. We're familiar with this story, right? It's the introduction to the child Moses. As you know, the story, fast forward through the story, Miriam is there waiting beside the river. The king's daughter, Pharaoh's daughter, comes down to bathe. And there we see a divinely orchestrated moment. You could call this a divine appointment, as this baby, who is a beautiful child, waiting in the reeds, the Pharaoh's daughter coming down to bathe, and she meets this child, she meets Miriam, and at that point takes him as his own, and we see the plan of God being put forth. I mean, I would have loved to have been the parents there, stepping back and saying, wow, he wasn't murdered, and he's in the king's house. What could God do with this? And we have this boy raised in Pharaoh's home, trained with all the scholars, trained in the art of war. He would have been a man groomed, at least this is what Josephus believes, groomed for the position of Pharaoh. And now he's hit 40 years old, and Moses is ready to work. Look at verse 11. Chapter 2, verse 11. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went unto his brethren and looked on their burdens and spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren, and he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. And that's going to continue on to how he meets his wife to be and his father-in-law and all that. This story, again, we're familiar with. But the thing I find amazing about this story is, who was destined to deliver Israel? Do you think he knew that? According to Acts 7, when Stephen stands up and preaches and he refers back to the Old Testament, in Acts 7, Stephen references this story, and according to Acts 7, there seems to be an indication that Moses full well recognized, in the words of the book of Esther, I'm a man prepared for this time. And he, at 40 years old, he had been educated, he had been trained, he was an Israelite, choosing not to suffer, to experience the pleasures of sin for a season. He chose to suffer affliction with the people of God. He chose to identify himself with them. He's made for them. He's made of God for them. And he steps in at age 40 because in Moses' mind, it's time. In fact, go to 7 here real quick, because I want you to see this, because Stephen makes it very clear what's happening. Acts chapter 7. Look at verse 22. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, was mighty in words and deeds, and when he was full 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit the brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. So at one glance, you might say, man, this guy's doing good. That's the bang, bang, shoot 'em up, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood that we like. I mean, go in there and take it on your own shoulders and do it right. And man, if you stand up, the people will flock to you. That's what's running through Moses' mind. Look at verse 25. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove and would have set them at once again, saying, sirs, ye are brethren, why do you wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, who made thee a ruler and judge over us? So what is happening in this passage is this. Moses knows he's prepared, he's skilled, he's gifted, he's trained, and he says, It's my time to shine, and I'm going to deliver Israel. And he steps in with his sword, as it were, and tries to do the work in the arm of the flesh. And God's work is often not done with the sword. It's often done with a humble, meek spirit. And he is rejected. Now, this would be a foretaste of Christ, who was also rejected. But as one commentator put it this way, these two incidents prove that neither were the Israelites yet ready to go out of Egypt, nor Moses prepared to be their leader. It was by the staff and not the sword, by meekness and not the wrath of Moses, that God was set to accomplish the great work of deliverance. Was Moses gifted for this work of deliverance? What was Moses' error? He didn't wait. But you would say he had every reason to act. I mean, he's made for such a time as this. In my experience, in my own short life, one of my greatest pitfalls to waiting on the Lord is when I feel I have every legitimate reason to act. Can I be very candid with you for a moment? If I am, you guys, we're going to have to be best friends forever if I'm going to be this honest with you. I have a desire, I've had a desire for quite some time, to be able to help, how do I say this? To Ephesians chapter 4, there's a listing of giftings for a local body. Evangelist is one of them. And I have desired for a number of years to be able to be a staff evangelist at the church, that I could help that church, help them in the role with the gifting that God has given me. And I know for a fact that God has gifted me. I know for a fact that God has made me for the work that I have done. But earlier in the year, last year, I found myself wrestling and pleading all of my giftings and skills before the Lord, saying, God, it's time you should be putting me in that position. And the Lord has chosen not to. Because Caleb Reed is often far too impatient and far too full of himself, as maybe Moses was. Moses concluded, I am the man to deliver. I'm gifted, talented, called by God. I can do it. And he takes it upon himself, and he violently kills an Egyptian, and the people won't rally with him. And so he flees for his life. And next time we pick up with Moses, he's on the backside of the desert 40 years later, learning the lesson that God wanted him to learn. And that is meekness. So that when in a burning, fiery bush, Moses walks up to the bush, is astounded by it. God speaks to him. Now, Moses, it's time. It's all ready. I've heard their cry. I have prepared everything. And Moses, the man I prepared, the man I called, the man I gifted, now, Moses, you're ready to go deliver him. And Moses says, who am I? Who am I that I could deliver? Now, you could say, well, Moses gets kind of down in the mouth. He gets kind of wimpy. He gets kind of mopey about it, everything. He does do that. I think in some ways he went too far. But the truth is, when you get to Numbers chapter 11, and there's people prophesying in the camp, and Joshua runs to Moses and says, hey, defend your honor. Tell those guys to stop prophesying. He says, would you defend me? I wish that all of God's servants had the Spirit of God in them. What you see in the 40 years on the backside of the desert is God working into a man what actually it takes to lead the children of Israel. And how many times have we, because we are truly gifted of God, because we are truly prepared of God, have jumped in front of God, when in fact God calls us to walk as he leads. Next scenario. Go with me to Exodus 32. Fast forward again. Now this one, I'm just going to be totally honest with you. I'm still wrestling with this one, with all the details and applications to my own life. But in Exodus 32, you see a group of Moses going up into the mount to receive the commandments of the Lord, and the people get antsy. and they're frustrated that he's not come down. Look at verse 1 of chapter 32. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the gold earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them to me. And they and all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them. And he received them into their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. There's a theme in both Exodus 32 and then in Exodus chapter 2 of recognizing, see, here's what the children of Israel recognized. They recognized, we need a leader. We need a God. We don't know where our leader is. And we don't know what God is up to. So we are going to get us a leader and a God in Aaron and the calf. And the thing that brings God's great displeasure against them is that they attributed the works of God to the calf and worshiped him. When God says, it's me that divided the water. It's me that sent the plagues. It's me that brought you out. As I'm processing this through, I don't necessarily, I've never been tempted to make a golden calf. I've never been tempted to take my wife's jewelry and melt them into something to worship. But I have many times been tempted to worship something other than the true God. Worship money. Worship influence. Worship fame, worship security, worship something that God, it doesn't seem like you're providing here. God, it doesn't look like you're answering over here. So if I can just work this side job to make a little money, since you won't answer here, this will provide for my needs. And I end up raising up my own golden calf, calling it the deliverance of God. When I was in college, there was a young man that had a school bill he had to pay, and the policy that the school had was you couldn't start a new semester with an outstanding bill, so you had to have your old bill cleared off, paid for, before you could start a new semester of school. And so spring semester, so after Christmas break, he comes back, and everybody knew he had had a big debt, and he'd been praying about it, and still all through his Christmas break, there had been no deliverance. And he was doing some nursing home ministry and on his Christmas break. So he stands up and he tells this story to all of us. He said, I was on nursing home ministry, and I just want to tell you how God provided. I was on nursing home ministry, and there was a man that was there that I was preaching, and afterwards he came and said, you're a fine young man. Is there anything I can do for you? And he said, I just felt like it was God. So I got down beside him and I asked him for $6,000 to pay for my school bill. He says, he hasn't sent the check yet, but he promised he would. And everybody internally went, ah, that's not God. And the check never came, and it was not God. There is a certain cringeworthiness when we step out before God and look to something other than God, and God judges these people because they were turning to a false God. There's still much that I'm processing through this passage, but the challenge is that when you do not wait for God's deliverance and his provision and for his timing, people are hurt. Many mistakes are made. And then the last one we're going to go to, because I'm about out of time, go to Psalm 31. Psalm 31. Look down at verse 22. Actually, excuse me. Yes, verse 22. Psalm 31, verse 22. For I said in my haste, I am cut off from before thine eyes. Nevertheless, thou heardest the voice of my supplications when I cried unto thee. O love the Lord, all ye his saints, for the Lord preserveth the faithful and plentifully rewardeth the proud doer. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all ye that hope in the Lord. Verses 23 and verse 24 is that exaltation of the heart going back to resting in the Lord. But what does the first phrase of verse 22 say? He says, in my haste, I said, I am cut off before thine eyes. Men and women who do not wait on the Lord make hasty statements, make hasty accusations, and conclude that God has forgotten, that God has turned his back, and people who will not wait on the Lord often turn their back on the Lord in their haste. So here's my final word of challenge to us, the errors of waiting. If you have found yourself saying, I feel like God has left us to dry. I feel like the master artist has put his brush down and walked away from the easel, and I'm sitting here waiting patiently, and he's forgotten about me. Those thoughts, those accusations often come from haste, a refusal to wait on the Lord. And the old adage, haste makes waste. Yes, we do dumb things. We don't wait on the Lord. So what is the solution for a heart that's filled with haste? Wait. Coming back to that place of resting and binding ourselves to the Lord. And he says there in verse 24, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart, all ye that hope in the Lord.